Welcome back to syndicatednews.net. Today's segment of Men Matter. And we're going to replay a very short segment of a show I did several months ago with a father who suffered from parental alienation. Dr. Wagner and Dr. McGuire are going to discuss this particular case. Listen in. Perhaps you have your opinion on this case as well, and you want to call in or Skype in. Here we go.
We're talking to
Patrick Perger, Deltona, Florida.
And where are you originally from, Pat?
Originally, I'm from Pennsylvania, but I spent most of my adult life in metropolitan New York area, Westchester County, Putnam County, New York.
And how many years were you a police officer in Westchester County?
I retired from the Westchester County Department of Public Safety on November 2nd, 1987.
Once you divorced, you were given visitation on Sundays from 10 to 2?
She adhered to that for about 6 months or so. My child, now he's a grown man, he's 26 years of age, he turned 26 last week,
mm-hmm.
And it'll be 15 years this coming January since we had quality time together. I've been totally alienated from my only child, and it's a hard pill to swallow, so to speak.
Has your relationship with your child ever corrected itself?
Oh, never, never. I wasn't able to see my child. We lived in the same town, and I couldn't see him for a whole year. And after that, I went totally broke, and I was kicked into the streets on New Year's Eve out of my house, which she had taken my child and left 18 months prior. The judge up there refused to permit me to stay there for 2 more weeks. He said, if New Year's coming in, you better be going out, or else you'll just surrender yourself to the Putnam County Sheriff's Department, and you're getting 90 days in the county jail. It was a sad state of affairs. When my child was in school, I had to hire an attorney to write a letter because my ex told the school assistant superintendent, do not give me any of my child's school records. Do not permit me to purchase his school pictures. This is totally uncalled for. I went as far as contacted the Department of Education in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I had requested a copy of the FERPA Act of 1974, which outlines the rights of a non-custodial parent. And it's quite clear in there what is incumbent upon the school and the courts as far as withholding information from the non-custodial parent. And I wrote a letter to the school superintendent, and I had to say, got the letter, then they started cooperating, and I was able to purchase my child's school pictures and get report cards, school calendar and things too. I was at the point where I was ready. I didn't know what to do. I was ready to just drive off into, and then he went off to college. I didn't hear from, had a total breakdown then as far as communications go because I had no way of getting in touch with him. And then I checked with the school when his college graduation came up, and they were very cooperative at his university. And I received passes, and current wife and I, we went to his college graduation to see him, and he was friendlier then, and we tried to reach out to him and have a better relationship, but it only went as far as emails. But I kept in touch with him. I saved copies of all the letters and emails and cards that I sent him. And here's a point that I want to make to show about parent alienation. I lost everything. I went through bankruptcy. I went broke fighting the system to see my child. And at the time, when I got kicked out of my house, I ended up living with an acquaintance on a farm in South Carolina. I had nowhere to go. I remember it was for my child's 13th birthday. I was able to scrape enough money together. I got him purchased a birthday card. And I put a $50 bill into it and sent it to him, wishing him a happy birthday. And his mother made him send it back. And I was hurt by that. And I wrote a letter to him stating, I said, son, I know this isn't your idea. Whenever you want the money, it'll be here for you. And I said, you just let me know. And I sent a letter to him, and she wrote back to me, you're right, it wasn't his idea, it was my idea. So therefore, I don't even think that he ever saw that card or that money. And I don't think that he received it. A lot of the emails that I sent to him, and thank God I saved everything on my computer, all the emails, and I have a box full of cards and letters that I sent to him that I'm sure that he didn't receive, if any, very few of them. And I never lost contact with him. I didn't hear from him, but I continued to write, and that's why I suspect of the fact that he ever received my correspondence to him. And we were communicating by telephone for a while his mother was working, and he'd get out of school when he was in high school. We would talk via telephone. And then she found out about that, and she put a stop to that real quick. I received a call from him on February 16th of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And he stated, I was shocked, I didn't even know who it was, and he said, I know I've never listened to your side of it, I listened to my mother, I never listened to your side of it, and I want to put this behind me now.
How interesting.
He said, my girlfriend told me that I should call you, and I said, well, son, I said, you're my only child, and I love you, and I could never hold anything against you. I said, mean the world to me. And we talked for about 3 hours. And unbeknownst to me at the time, his girlfriend was there at the time. And so I asked him, I said, can I call you in the future? He said, sure. And I was so elated. I thought this was the beginning of a relationship again between me and my only child. And in June of 2009, I received a email from him. Matter of fact, I pull it up on my computer, and I can...
And it's very likely that his mother guides him, and when he goes ahead and he makes friends with you, she makes it so absolutely impossible that it's literally impossible for him to...
She knew what she was doing. She's a very intelligent woman. She totally alienated him from me, my family, and my friends. My family has not seen my child or talked to my child since August of 1994. Several of my family members have passed on, and they never got to see him or talk to him, including his godfather and my brother and a few others. And so she knew what she was doing, you know, by alienating him. You know, let's see if I can find it.
Did you find it?
Yes, I just found it now.
Excellent.
He sent me an email. It was on July 20th of 2009, and he said, "Hey, Dad, you know, we talked about a few little things," and then he said, "On a more somber note, I need to take a break from communicating with you. I have a lot going on in my life, and particularly in my head right now, and the tenuous relationship is contributing to anxiety and stress that is too much for me."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "On a more somber note, I need to take a break from communicating with you. I have a lot going on in my life, and particularly right now, the tenuous relationship we've been having is contributing to anxiety and stress that is too much for me." And he said, "I still wish you the best." And I couldn't believe what he, you know, I don't know what that... What made him break off communication? The only thing I figured is the fact that his mother must have found out.
Absolutely.
And she just put a
kibosh.
Kibosh to it.
Absolutely.
And I wrote a letter back to him, an email. It's very touching, but it's personal, so I don't really want to go into it.
Of course not. That's private between you two. But what we want to know about is, what would you have done differently now that all these years have passed? What would you have done differently? What I've been asking parents is, would you have stayed married to someone in spite of how you and she were not getting along? just to keep him if you knew that this was down the road?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because an environment like that is not good for anyone. She is the one that requested a divorce, and I said, well, if that's what you want, I'm not going to fight you for it. I was working. I was working three jobs. She was a stay-at-home mom. But to stay together like that, now, the best thing was that we separated. But it's the same thing, the fact that my current wife is not only my wife, but my best friend. We do everything together, and she's...
What a lovely thing to say. What a lovely thing. Alienated children have to keep that position for the alienated parents, or they make their own lives miserable. It's been found through studies that these parents demand of the children absolute loyalty and make the child think that all hell's going to break loose if the relationship is renewed in any way. And the kids, in order to keep the peace, tend to leave things as they are, try to keep things normalized as much as they can. I wanted to ask you, did you see the picketers at the courthouse?
Oh, absolutely. I was.
What did you think of that? Give me your first impression when you saw that.
Well, first of all, I wondered what was going on. I was in a hurry, so I had to go into the courthouse, take care of some business in there briefly. So on my way out, I made it my business to go over and to find out what was going on. So I stopped a couple of the picketers and asked them what was going on, and they explained to me what was going on with the gentleman in family court and being alienated from his children and whatnot.
Something you're very familiar with.
Oh, yes. So I started marching with them.
You're kidding.
No, absolutely.
We didn't know that. When did this happen?
Oh, gosh, what day was that? I'd have to look back in my diary now. I'm not sure what day it was they were up there picketing.
Congratulations. Good for you.
That's when I gave them my name and the person that they were picketing for. I start telling them about my plight, and they said, wow, you didn't stand a chance in the world. And once I went through this, I entered myself into therapy, and that was a godsend for me. That helped me tremendously dealing with all of this.
Were you the famous father that said, I love this country, but my country doesn't love me?
Yes, I am.
You are, aren't you? Because I understand you were in the military.
Yeah, I'm a Marine Corps combat veteran.
Then you're a Marine.
Yes.
There is no such thing as an ex-Marine.
No. Once a Marine, always a Marine.
And you love this country, don't you?
I love the country. I don't love my government. I won't fly the American flag anymore, but I fly my Marine Corps flag.
Aww.
My Marine Corps flag, I fly it religiously. I love the military. I love my country, but I hate my government. I don't trust the government. I don't trust politicians, no matter what party they are. I do not trust the court system. Absolutely no way, shape, or form. It's totally absurd, and thank God both times, two different judges, they saw right through it, and they said, this is ridiculous. This man should have never been brought in here. But the thing about it was, it cost me $1,500 to hire an attorney to go to court. That's not right. And he had represented me, and the judge permitted him to represent her. I said, this is a conflict of interest. He said, well, I'll decide if it's a conflict of interest or not. You know, and on top of that, he rubbed salt into the wounds. He made me pay him for her fees, which he didn't even charge his sister, but that's neither here nor there. I said, something's really wrong with this picture. And I remember speaking when I was in New York. I spoke to a gentleman who was running for, U.S. Congress from up in my district. And he was a Vietnam veteran, a Congressional Medal of Honor winner, and he went through similar things that I went through in the court system. And he told me, he said, Patrick, he said, best thing you can do is let go. He said, you'll never win. He said, this court is so biased.
And also, I should mention, this is not a usual parental alienation case. His ex had many judges in her family. Do you want to give us the list?
Well, her late father, who was to me, I idolized the man. He was great. He had passed away before we divorced. He was a New York State Supreme Court justice, a wonderful man. And her stepmother had a couple of relatives. One was a chief administrative judge in the Supreme Court in the 9th Judicial District. And another one was a federal judge in that district in White Plains, New York. And her cousin, I believe he's still currently a city judge in the city of Yonkers, and her brother and a couple of cousins were practicing attorneys, all in the 9th Judicial District, and they refused me a change of venue. So, like they said, other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't stand a chance, and and I overcame that, because they took everything from me as far as materialistic things go. They broke me, but they never took my dignity, which I wouldn't permit anyone to take my dignity. And through the grace of God, I overcame everything and picked myself up, and I live in a wonderful life. The only thing missing from my life is my only child. Can you imagine if I would have badmouthed my ex to my child the way she badmouthed me to my child? He would have caught it from both ends. He would be totally messed up in the head. Like King Solomon in the Bible, when two women went before King Solomon, said, "This is my child." And the other one said, "No, this is my child." And King Solomon said, "No, I'll cut the child in half. You both have half." And a real mother said, "No, let her have him." That's the way I felt with my child. Rather than me bad-mouthing his mother to him and screwing him up in the head that much more, let her do it. I can take it.
Good for you. You're a good dad.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are collecting the sentiments and the statements from mothers and fathers who have been alienated from their children and giving them an opportunity to air their side of the story. And would you give us just two or three sentences that you would tell your son right now if you were going to give him a greeting?
Son, I love you more today than I did the day you were born, if that's possible. I'll always love you. I'll always be here for you as long as the Lord is willing. It's so sad that you had to come to this and you don't really know your father as you should. You should not have been deprived of a father. And it's never too late. I just wish the best for you and pray for you. I love you. I love you. Bless you.
Good evening. We're back, and it was a very difficult interview. That was several months ago, and one of the doctors with us is... Are you both here, gentlemen?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, then proceed with the show.
A very moving and heartfelt rendering of what happened, and in my own experience and those I've spoken with of others, this is the unfortunate outcome from years and years of frustrating battles, frustrating circumstances, and a seemingly, and all too often, unresponsiveness of the court or the various agencies or players around that to realize that the clock is ticking. Kids grow up in a blink. And when you get a situation of alienation, it engenders a sense of giving some time to work things out, which I think is a natural occurrence of the courts or of the system to try and find a middle ground. That, unfortunately, is taken advantage of by a parent or parents or circumstances which will alienate a child from one parent. And the outcome is long-term separation with certainly deleterious effects on the children and the slow degradation of the parent who's been separated. And I could hear in his voice and from his description of his experiences the situation where he was describing at the end. He seems to have lost faith in the system. And in that circumstance, I think rightfully so.
Jim, what do you think?
Well, I felt very bad for Pat Berger. And like so many other fathers, I noted, he said he was kicked onto the street. He went through bankruptcy. He had to scrape up enough money to send his son a $50 bill. He had to call his son behind the son's mother's back. And his son had been alienated from the rest of his family for, I tallied it up, 17 years. And then he asked, not then, but during, he asked, he had to find out what the rights of the non-custodial parent was. Does this typify for you some of what has gone on in your case, what you believe has been going on in many fathers' cases?
Well, Jim, one point really hit to home, and that was the FERPA Act. That's the Educational Records Privacy Act that allows any parent, actually, but seemingly it's used more by non-custodial parents, to obtain school records. I had to follow that same route. And letters and calls, please send me this. I would get the cursory things, but I couldn't get the entire record, certainly report cards. But with the separation and with the alienation that was being foisted, it really became a battle to even present a sense of, I'm their father, I'm entitled to these records. If I were standing there and this were any other circumstance, I'd be welcome with open arms. But given the poisoning that went on, I actually had to invoke FERPA to get a school principal to send me the complete records of my children from the school. And that I had to do that, I think, really pointed out the systematic and almost robotic response that alienation engenders in some of the larger players, the school system, for one. Very difficult to find yourself as a second-class citizen in circumstances where your own children are involved. And it's just the fact that you file it almost confirms that you are in the back. So I could sympathize directly with him on that. And that leads to another situation, which, of course, I know I've heard the same from other fathers, too, I've spoken to and corresponded with and through organizations, that records of any kind, school, and particularly for mental health records, therapists, which seem to be ubiquitous in these circumstances, are all directly blunt in saying, no, we can't give those to you. And it really cuts a big part of their lives out. They don't even know how they're reacting and what is going on in their lives, and that's a personal matter. It makes you feel very empty.
And Patrick Perger said exactly that. They took everything from me. I think there's a mindset out there in society that fathers have no feeling, that there's some kind of vacuous being that has no heart, no soul, doesn't give a darn about really much of anything, except I'm not sure what they think that we really do care about. But the fact of the matter is, we're going to talk to other men who are going to have similar stories, and all the stories are going to be very much the same. And here in the state of Florida, if you have what they call shared parenting, you're supposed to have access to what's going on in the children's life. But if you're dealing with an alienating parent, and that alienating parent gets to the school, gets to the counselors, gets to the teachers, gets to the principals, and gets to everybody else before you do, or before you can allow yourself to be seen as human, by the time you get there, you're walking a nuclear minefield. Here you are, an MD, Dr. McGuire, and here you are having to enter the school system defending yourself for who you are, for what you are, and for simply being a parent. You would have more respect if you went into the school and didn't have any kids in the school, would you not?
Actually, that's quite true, and let me give you a very stark example. On my first visit to the elementary school, I was met at the door by a receptionist, then ushered into the principal's office, where, having just met this woman for the first time, I hear another footsteps behind me, and in comes the another teacher or custodian of some sort there, big guy who just sits down. I don't know this man from Adam. And I said, if I'm interrupting, I can come back. She says, oh, no, I just wanted someone here.
Yeah.
And I said, but I asked the man, are you one of their teachers? And he didn't say anything. And this principal said, well, I just wanted to have someone here with us. And I got it, which was she was building this atmosphere of, you know, danger, Will Robinson, father in the building. And if I had just come in and asked for some information or wanted to speak with her in general, maybe perhaps enrolling the kids if I had been new to town, there's none of that cloud of... It really set the tone for the future from that point on. With one exception, there was an interim principal who was there who was very much understanding of the whole circumstance. But I think that happens to a lot of fathers and mothers who are alienated too. But parents who are alienated are immediately looked on as separated from and deserving less attention or rights to any activity or involvement in their child's life.
Let's go to the issue of rights, because Patrick Perger talked about rights, and he came to the point where he didn't know if he had any rights or not. As a matter of fact, I think a lot of fathers believe that after they get shook In other words, after they're on the street, after they've met with the general magistrate, after everything they've worked all their lives for has been taken from them, including their children, they go, oh my God, I don't have any rights at all. And at that point in time, they wonder what to do. Some of them, probably most of them, think first thing that I need to do is to call a lawyer. What lawyer? God only knows what lawyer. There's all kinds of lawyers that have signs out in front about family law. You don't know if you're going to get the right lawyer. You don't know if these lawyers understand parental alienation. You're probably going to have to educate them as well, but you're going to pay them $350 an hour to give them the education. So what right, even if you have an attorney, can you obtain in this country to get to be with your own children?
That's a very strong point, and one that I addressed at several points along the way. And I think we spoke about this before. Much like Mr. Perger's case, once the system gears up, you are guilty in whatever manner they choose to describe you, unfit or unwilling, or the adjectives could go on and on. I've heard them all. And you must, in that sense, prove your innocence. And so rather than stop and say, do we have something right here in front of us that would cause us to violate a fundamental constitutional, addressed by the Supreme Court in many cases over the years, right of children and parents to be together, that a parent can make decisions for and be involved in the lives of his children, it just vanishes while this gearing up causes a so-called cautionary, let's take some time, let's evaluate it mode. In a sense, the state, in my experience, takes over. The agencies that are involved take over and act, quote, as the parent, unquote, until such time as they feel that they're not needed, or to exclude, in my case, me, to exclude you until you meet, quote, their requirements, which are never quite laid out. And it becomes more of a process of separation, so that the state now takes, essentially, control of your children for no other reason than someone said this, or there's a question about that in the absence of any reason, and you're powerless without quite a bit of money or influence to change that circumstance. It's a usurpation of parental rights, which I think goes to the core of the larger problem.
Well, Dr. McGuire, I want to go back to this issue of rights, but the system, as you call it, looks at this father as being irrational, you might say. But my question is, who's got the paranoia? The father or the system? Isn't the system out of control? Isn't the system paranoid? Doesn't the system overreact? And when people are paranoid, defensive, and overreactive, isn't that a sign of pathology? So who's got the pathology here? The parent who's simply trying to see his kids, or the system that's reacting to this poor parent in a pathological way?
The system.
The system.
And the system is paranoid party here. And I think it's on a couple levels. While ostensibly the system is designed to act to protect and to serve families, children, then all of the support systems come in. And the court responds to that, I think. I think it takes an astute presence on the bench to pick this up early. But there's an allegation or a comment or a disagreement, or in my case, these horrible allegations of abuse. And suddenly, I think there's more than one thing at play here. One, hearing the words child abuse, in my case, everyone goes into a defensive mode. Certainly, at one level, you want to think that they're acting to say, we're going to make sure we get this evaluated and checked for the safety of the kids. All right. But that really doesn't take much time. It can be looked at very quickly, or should be. But then there's the other.
I might stop you just for a minute. If you have a person who's been accused of some kind of criminal activity, they'll be out on bail and back to normal, potentially, in 24 to 48 hours or before. So what's the deal with the parent that they can't put him out on bail until such time as something is proven evidentially against him?
Well, Jim, let's take a moment, and we invite into our conversation Dr. Miola. He's actually a doctor of divinity, and I think he has something very interesting to say. Dr. Miola, please meet Dr. Wardner and Dr. McGuire.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello there.
Good evening. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. On the topic, as you guys were just discussing, and I'm actually a child of divorce myself, the problem with the system and why they do things the way they do. Under law, I study more law than I do the of divinity, believe it or not. My divinity that I received my doctorate in was many, many years ago, but still, of course, I hold that dear to my heart. My study as of late has been law, and the reason they treat parents in general, whether you're together as a couple or if you've been separated or divorced, the way that they do is they actually have a vested interest in the child. Without going into a whole lot of legal aspects of it, we don't have the rights that a lot of people think we do. And you stated it quite clearly earlier in your conversation with the aspect of you're guilty till proven innocent. And that is exactly the type of law system we are currently operating under.
I agree. And in my situation, once that decision of the state taking on an interest in the safety or care of the children, it opens up a huge arena for social services, therapists, and all of these ancillary, quote, protectors to come in. And there is never a consensus from that point. And I think part of it is that no one wants to say, oh, I was involved in this, and it turned out that the person that was accused or alleged turned out to be a bad actor. And so they reverse the thought. I don't know who said it, maybe Jefferson, that 99 people go free who did something to let one person who is innocent not suffer a confinement. I'm misstating that, of course, but they're reversing that to say, I don't want to be on the front page as having been the social services worker or the therapist or the judge or the friend of the court or the GAO who was involved where, quote, someone we allowed back into the lives of their children turned out to be inappropriate. And so everyone must suffer so that they themselves don't wind up in the paper.
We have all these rights in this country. And the question that I'm asking, and I want to go back to it before, and this caller can chime in. A right is a right is a right. If you have a right, then I think you have a right. Now, we can pull out Webster and see what that word really means. But in this country, what does it mean to have a right? It seems to mean absolutely, absolutely nothing. Because you got a right to nothing in this country unless you get an attorney. Then if you get an attorney and you spend $500,000, you might find that you've got a right, but you're going to dig it and pay for it. That's the only way you're going to obtain it, because the right that should be a right, which would be just natural, given by God license, you don't have in America today.
No, you absolutely do not. And there's a legal reason why you do not have that. We have all been brought up to believe we have certain rights. And people love to read the Constitution. And it's a fantastic document, very well written. In the beginning, under the Republic, we had the inalienable, God-given right. A lot of people did not understand, the colonists especially, did not understand truly what that meant. Where the law changed, the Constitution lays out the three levels of government, okay, as far as the law. The last one being the smallest mentioned in the Constitution is Admiralty / Maritime Law, which is law of the sea. It has to do with international commerce. What has happened in the Constitution, and they brought it about pretty sneaky, actually, but it's quite obvious in law exactly what they did. Under the 14th Amendment, and since Abraham Lincoln, declared a state of an emergency, this is how they got the 14th Amendment in. As it's written, by law, the amendment is actually what is referred to in law as a trust, okay? We have been, without our knowledge, upon birth, become beneficiaries of the trust. Now, that changed our court system. We have not had an official constitutional sitting judge since 1938. All judges since then have been arbitrators of international law, maritime law. What they managed to do was take that international commerce law and bring it into the public sector. You ever hear the expression, 9/10 of the law? Well, that's true nowadays in America, because that tenth that's left over is actually owned by the government trust of the 14th Amendment. There is a legal way, however, if you really want to spend the time and go through the process of removing yourself from the trust, just like you would any trust that your parents would have set up for you. Okay, it's the exact same document, the same type of document. And you would have to go through probate court to have yourself removed from the trust. The advantage to having yourself removed from the trust and no longer considered a beneficiary of the trust, it moves you back into the House of the Republic under the original first 10 amendments of the Constitution, where you have full inalienable rights.
How does this apply to the parent who may or may not understand this, which I'm very interested in where you're going, but I'm asking myself, how do I get the soup I have in front of me onto this spoon that you're talking about? How can the parent who can't get to his kids utilize this, or maybe I should ask, can this be utilized, this knowledge, to help a person be able to access his right in the United States of America?
Yes, absolutely it can, but it's a long process, and it's always better to start off the process before you get into the situation. But you can, like I stated earlier, is they have a vested interest in your child, because the child upon birth is a beneficiary of the trust. They're protecting their interest, okay?
That's very interesting.
Yeah, the school system, as far as public school system, is intentionally designed the way it is to make the product, which is, or the labor, I should say, which is the people who attend the schools, they are the new labor force, which they create a product. But really, under law, the human body is no longer yours. You no longer own it under the trust. Under law, actually, upon birth, you are dead to the law because you became a corporation. Now, you doctors understand, because you own businesses, you understand what a corporation is. And all those involved in the corporation have a say-so in the raising and bringing about of that product. And that's what your child is. It's something more than a product to the system.
Dr. McGuire, I am just for a second. Dr. McGuire, I'm absolutely fascinated with this gentleman and what he has to say. What do you think about this?
I need to close my mouth and get my chin off the table for a second. But, yes,
go ahead, Kevin.
It seems it segues in a very clear manner, and thank you for putting it so succinctly. It segues in a very clear manner, sort of the wandering what ifs and why is this happening that we all experience, at least I have, the sort of that big question, how can you do this? How can you do this to me? How can you do it to my kids? This may give a deeper, if not darker, reason for why these things seem to happen with such ease.
Very, very true. They can come in anytime they want, knock on your door with a warrant, sometimes without, and check on your kids. Well, what gives them the right to do these things and to have a say in your children? It's because of the 14th Amendment trust that's been established in the Constitution, gives them the right to do as they seem fit.
When you said there's a way around that, we were talking before the show a little bit about a topic such as the time it takes to wind your way through the system in these circumstances. If one were to pursue the line that you've drawn here to perhaps even take this on, is it in the legal glacial time period that we all associate with it, a year to do this, a year to do that, et cetera?
Well, it does come down to a time period because it is law. You would have to first write a declaration, your own declaration, and depending on what state you live in is how many times you're required by law to publish your declaration in the paper. That's step one. All right. And what that declaration is you are declaring yourself an independent, no longer part of the trust. And then you would have to go to the next step, just like any kind of trust that's ever been set up, which would be, in fact, probate court. Now, we know the way the court systems are, and especially when you're approaching the legal system of this particular incident, could take quite a long time. And you have to do your own studies because you cannot get an attorney to represent you. The reason why you can't get an attorney to represent you, first of all, most attorneys do not understand it. Like you were explaining, you've got to teach them because they're only taught in law school the procedures, not the actual law, believe it or not. Do you know what the bar is?
I always thought it was a place where the lawyers met to figure out how to charge as much as possible for phone calls, emails, and text messages, and any kind of document that they print. Am I wrong?
Well, you're pretty much summed it up. Right, you're entering the wolf's den. Don't go in there and try to be a bigger wolf because you're going to fail.
I've talked to a number of people who, whether they're alienated parents or not, they have had encumbrances with getting to their children, their grandchildren, or their partner has difficulty getting to their children or whatever. And upon talking to, you know, who am I to recommend anything to anybody? I have been so unsuccessful myself. But I said, it sounds like the only thing you're going to be able to do is to go pro se. And before I entered this mess, I would not have known what even that meant. And this individual didn't have any idea what pro se meant. But problem is that we are not prepared to take this Goliath on. We don't have the information. we don't know the laws that have already been instituted and put in place and are so against us. And when you stop to think that you're going to get police visitation simply because you have a desire to be with your kids, we're already so far down this road that it's hard to imagine how we can get back. I mean, if a father wants to be with his kids, he's going to be getting visitations from the police. What's going on? How far down the road are we already? And so many fathers, this show is Men Matter. And the question is, do men matter? I said to someone recently, we have a show called Men Matter. Is it reasonable that we have a show called Men Matter? How is it possible that in our society today we even have to have this discussion that men matter? This is unbelievable. And yet the laws that have been instituted in this land have put us in a position where men don't know who they are anymore. They don't know if they can discipline their kids anymore. They don't know if they can tell their kids what to do or what not to do. They don't even know if they can see their kids. And they're lucky, I suppose, if they can be what they call a visitor. But here in Florida, you don't call it a visit. You're a visitor. You pack your bag. You visit your kid. But we're not going to call it that because the word somehow rubs people the wrong way. We're way, way, way down the road because most men have already accepted the fact that when someone says you're a visitor, you leave the kid and you just send in the check.
And absolutely. The men in this country and in families, whether you have a family or not, I would have to say the big downfall or the reason they were able to accomplish as much as they have in this country because of the law has been the downfall of the family. We've lost our founding values, as it were. The people in America no longer know who they are or where they came from and for what reasons their great-great-grandparents ever came to America to begin with. And until we discover and take back the power of self, nobody takes responsibility for their own actions. It's always pointing the finger. It's somebody else's fault. Nobody stands up and takes responsibility for their own actions. And we as men have to take back the family unit. We are in charge. You can live quite comfortably if you learn to live within your means. And we have been programmed, if you will, to live on credit. I have a family of five. There is one working spouse in the household. We live debt-free. Other than my mortgage is not 100% paid off yet. But other than that, we live debt-free on one income, and somebody is home with the kids to take them to school, be there when they're not. The best thing you can do for your kids is homeschool, but that's out of range for a lot of people, and I can understand that. But we have to take back ourselves as men.
Can I interrupt? I apologize for one interruption here. I know we're getting short. Excellent review of, I think, the larger problem. It's hard to encapsulate it as well as you've done. But I wanted to get back for a second to the nine-tenths topic we were just discussing and the trust. Given the time frame and the money that would be involved if you chose to go that way, and as you said, you'd have to start early. For those of us who are... they've already put some holes in the ship by the time we come to this information. Is most of this addressable through 14th Amendment, due process clause about fundamental rights and infringement by the government absent any reasonable need to do so? Or do you think that it goes to the formation of self-fulfilling delusion where the agencies or the state will say, well, we think there's a reason, we think we have a problem, therefore there is. We're going to start taking emails, and I've got an email site for the listeners, and it's men.matter.show@gmail.com. That's men.matter.show@gmail.com. So that'll give us a way to get questions in and entertain topics, and it's worth our time to have a lot more input now that we've got such a large number of people responding to it. And as we're running out of time, I want to thank the caller for what great information. I've been enlightened to things I had no idea existed, and I don't think I'm alone.
We want to say hi to Santa Monica, California tonight, and I would ask the listeners to recommend this show to other listeners that you feel would have a special interest in this show, Men Matter. Thank you.
And we wanted to let you know that we had a wonderful participant from the chat room and whom called into the show and shared with us tremendous information regarding the Constitution as well as the United States Bar Association and its actual meaning. In that we have not yet confirmed it, it would not be fair to make it a point of controversy that would affect the show. If you are an attorney, or even a barrister, and you have some light to shed on the topic, call into the show when we're on the air, Fridays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Men Matter, and anyone interested in or knowledgeable on the topic of constitutional law is invited to call the show. You can Skype in at Syndicated News.